Welcome back to another deep dive. We are incredibly glad you decided to join us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a great topic today.
It really is. And if you are tuning in right now, we already know you aren't here for a basic one-level overview.
Definitely not. You wouldn't be here for that.
Right. You're likely staring down the barrel of a major architectural overhaul, or maybe you're prepping for a senior-level infrastructure interview.
Or you could be a hiring manager.
Oh, yeah. A hiring manager tasked with sifting through a mountain of resumes, just trying to find an engineer who actually knows how to keep a massive corporate data center from collapsing.
It's harder than it sounds.
Exactly. You want to get straight to the core of what makes a virtualization environment tick without drowning in all that, you know, vendor marketing fluff.
Which there's a lot of.
So much of it. But you are in exactly the right place.
That is our mandate for today. We're taking some highly technical, pretty dense material and extracting the real architectural realities behind it.
Yeah, we aren't interested in what you can just memorize for a multiple choice exam.
No, we are interested in how these systems behave under the extreme stress of real world enterprise workloads.
So let's lay out the source material we are working with today. We're doing a comprehensive analysis of a highly regarded framework published on vMinstall.
Right, by Joe Sanchez.
Yes, Joe Sanchez. He's an IT infrastructure and operations VP who's been in the trenches since the late 90s.
He's seen it all.
He really has. The post is titled 25 Tough and Technical VMware Interview Questions and Answers.
And right off the bat, Sanchez makes his intent very clear.
He does.
This isn't a brain dump. It's not about memorizing trivia.
No, it's a targeted assessment. Mm-hmm. It's designed to expose whether a candidate has actually bled in the server room or if they've just, you know, clicked around a home lab a few times.
Huge difference between the two.
Huge. And we're going to emphasize these specific questions and their answers today, not just to give you the cheat sheet, but to help you, our listeners and readers, truly internalize the architecture.
The real value of Sanchez's approach is that he tests for systemic understanding.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when you build and provision vCenter, ESXi hosts, and the underlying storage and network fabrics, you are essentially building a house of cards.
Okay, a very expensive house of cards.
Exactly. And if you don't understand the hypervisor dependencies, the whole thing comes down.
So true.
We are going to break down the logic of his assessment so you can articulate the why behind the architecture.
Which is really what separates a senior architect from a junior admin.
100%.
All right, let's get right into the metal. Section one. Sanchez kicks off his assessment by focusing on the absolute bedrock of the environment.
Bare metal hardware.
Yep. Bare metal hardware and system requirements for ESXi versions 8 and 9.
He throws out a very common scenario here.
Oh, the unused server scenario.
Yeah. A company has a stack of unused server hardware or maybe some legacy network adapters lying around.
And management said, hey, spin up a new vSphere cluster on this to save some money.
We've all heard that one.
We really have. But before you ever mount an ISO or touch a configuration file, Sanchez wants to know your first move.
And the answer, of course, is verifying every single component against the VMware compatibility guide.
The compatibility guide.
Or the HCL, as it's often called, the hardware compatibility list.
And this is where a lot of infrastructure projects fail before they even begin, right?
Absolutely. The HCL is unforgiving. It is not a list of suggestions.
It's the law.
It is the law. In a massive enterprise environment, you weren't just checking if the server powers on.
Anyone can plug a server in.
Right. You are checking if the specific firmware version on your host bus adapter is certified to talk to the specific driver version bundled in the ESX image.
That is incredibly specific.
It has to be. If you ignore the compatibility guide, you are essentially building a rogue Frankenstein cluster.
Let's pause on that because I have definitely seen environments where a rogue IT manager deliberately ignored the HCL.
Oh, happens all the time. Usually for an edge cluster or a disaster recovery site.
Exactly. The argument was always, well, it's just compute. It installed fine. And we are saving $100,000 in CapEx.
Sure, the CapEx looks fantastic on day one. But let's look at day 200.
What happens on day 200?
Well, you have a cluster running unverified Broadcom NICs or an unsupported storage controller.
Yeah.
You start experiencing microscopic packet drops. Or maybe a memory leak in the driver causes the host to silently drop storage paths.
Just entirely silently.
Yep. The host doesn't know what's going wrong, and suddenly your mission-critical SQL server running on that host starts experiencing massive latency spikes.
And then the users start calling.
And then the hypervisor kernel panics, resulting in the dreaded purple screen of death. the PSOD.
Which leads directly into another one of Sanchez's core questions in this foundation section. You get that PSOD, your database is down, your company's losing money by the minute.
Stressful situation.
Incredibly. You immediately open a Severity 1 ticket with VMware Enterprise Support.
As you should.
But what happens when VMware Support pulls the log bundle and sees you are running on hardware that isn't on the compatibility guide?
This is the painful part. The support engineer will politely point to the log, highlight the unapproved hardware ID, and close the ticket.
They just close it.
They cannot and will not help you.
Wow.
Your enterprise support contract is effectively voided for that specific incident.
That is brutal.
They will tell you there are known issues with that chipset, and you are completely on your own to rebuild the environment on supported hardware.
That is a career-ending scenario for an architect who signed off on that design.
It really is. You cannot troubleshoot an unstable foundation.
Which is exactly why Sanchez front loads his assessment with hardware validation.
It's the only logical starting point.
Now, staying on the topic of hardware requirements, Sanchez asks for the minimum CPU and memory specs required to build an ESXi host running a 64-bit OS.
Something that takes full advantage of ESXi features.
Right. And the answer he is looking for is 2 CPU cores and 8 gigabytes of memory.
Yep. 2 cores, 8 gigs.
To someone looking at modern hardware, that seems almost impossibly small. I mean, my laptop has way more than that.
It does seem small, but understanding the spec requires understanding the architecture of a bare metal hypervisor.
How so?
Well, ESXi is incredibly lightweight.
Unlike Windows.
Exactly. Unlike a general-purpose operating system like Windows Server, which comes loaded with graphic interfaces, background services, thousands of unnecessary drivers.
Just bloat, essentially.
Yeah, ESX is a highly optimized, stripped-down kernel.
So those 2 cores and 8 gigs of RAM.
They are strictly the overhead required to run the VM kernel, the host daemon, and the management agents.
It's just the cost of admission.
Right. A senior engineer knows that you have to subtract that baseline from your overall capacity planning before you start sizing your virtual machine workloads.
Absolutely. You don't get to allocate 100% of your physical RAM to your guest VMs.
You have to leave resources for the hypervisor to actually manage the memory paging and CPU scheduling.
Okay, so before we move off the motherboard entirely, there is a very specific low-level BIOS setting Sanchez tests for.
Oh, this is a great question.
He asks what must be enabled in the physical server's BIOS to run ESXi. And the answer is the NX/XD bit.
The NX/XD bit.
Why is this specific CPU feature the Hill VMware dies on?
Well, the NX/XD bit, which stands for no execute or execute disable, is a fundamental hardware security feature.
What does it actually do?
It allows the CPU to segregate areas of memory for data storage versus code execution.
Okay, keeping them separate.
Right. In a virtualization environment, you have multiple entirely distinct virtual machines sharing the exact same physical memory banks.
Just physically sitting right next to each other on the RAM sticks.
Exactly. So if a malicious payload compromises a guest VM and attempts a buffer overflow attack.
To break out of the VM.
Yes, the NX/XD bit prevents that malicious code from executing in memory spaces reserved for the hypervisor or other VMs.
So it's hardware level quarantine.
Basically. If the hypervisor cannot guarantee memory isolation at the hardware level, it simply refuses to boot.
It won't even start.
Nope. So asking this question proves the candidate understands that virtualization security starts way below the operating system layer.
That is a brilliant bridge between hardware architecture and security. You aren't just an admin clicking through a wizard. You are configuring hardware-level memory protection.
That's the mindset you need.
Okay, so once that hardware is racked, cabled, and the BIOS is locked down, we move into the second phase of Sanchez's assessment.
Section 2.
Getting it running.
Mm-hmm.
This covers questions 6 through 10, focusing on the art of the ESXi installation.
And you know, installation might seem trivial, but at an enterprise scale, the method of installation dictates the stability of the entire cluster over its lifecycle.
Let's talk about those methods. Sanchez asks for the methods used for an interactive ESXi installation.
He points to CD, DVD, USB, and PXE boot from a deployment server.
Right, but the real meat of this section is when he contrasts an interactive installation with a scripted installation.
That's the big divide.
In an interactive install, you are physically or virtually mounting media, sitting at a console, and manually typing in host names, IP addresses, and root passwords.
which is fine for a home lab.
But for scripted installs, Sanchez points out that ESXi 8 and 9 utilize a kickstart file.
Often named something like ks_cust.cfg.
The contrast here is between managing a home lab and managing a global data center.
Precisely. If you have to deploy 50 Blade servers by Friday, you cannot sit there and interactively type in the configuration for each one.
You'd go crazy. And the risk of human error is simply too high.
Exactly. A scripted install relies on a central pre-boot execution environment.
A PXE server.
A PXE server. The bare metal server boots up, grabs an IP address, pulls down the ESXi image, and reads a text-based kickstart file.
And that file dictates exactly how it should configure its network, storage, and management interfaces without any human intervention.
Zero human touch.
Now, Sanchez highlights a very specific, almost funny-sounding command related to this.
I love this part.
He asks for the boot option command used to access the installer for these scripted deployments.
The candidate has to know to interrupt the boot process and pass the kernel option runweasel.
Runweasel.
Runweasel, pointing it to the kickstart file location.
On the surface, asking about runweasel sounds like a trivia question.
It really does.
Yeah.
But it's actually a brilliant filter.
How so?
It acts as a perfect filter because it proves repetition and automation. You don't learn the runweasel syntax by accident.
You don't just stumble upon it.
No, you learn it because you've been tasked with automating infrastructure deployment.
Treating infrastructure as code.
Exactly. In modern IT, if a host fails, you don't spend hours trying to fix the OS.
You wipe it.
You wipe it and let the kickstart script rebuild it identically in 10 minutes.
So when an interviewer hears a candidate confidently explain how to pass a kickstart file to the runweasel installer,
they know they're talking to someone who thinks in terms of scalable automation, not manual hand-holding.
That makes total sense. Let's talk about the specific configuration data that goes into those scripts.
The inputs.
Yeah, because Sanchez asks the candidate to name at least 5 of the 10 critical inputs required during an ESX install.
We're talking about keyboard layout, VLAN ID, IP address, subnet mask, default gateway.
Primary and secondary DNS.
Host name, installation location, and the root password.
Consider the impact of getting just one of those inputs wrong.
It's catastrophic.
If you have 10 admins manually installing hosts across 3 different shifts, someone is going to make a typo.
It's guaranteed. And if a host gets a slightly wrong subnet mask, it might be able to talk to some hosts, but not others.
Creating split brain scenarios in your clustering.
Right. Or if they forget to tag the management VLAN ID.
The host just drops off the network the second it reboots.
Exactly. If the DNS entries are pointing to legacy domain controllers, the host won't be able to authenticate users or resolve vCenter.
It creates a nightmare scenario called configuration drift.
Yes. When your hosts aren't identical, your high availability mechanisms fail unpredictably.
And Sanchez also throws in a troubleshooting question here.
What's the first thing to double check if a server simply refuses to load the installer?
We talked about the NXXD bit earlier. But he also emphasizes checking that the hardware clock is set to UTC.
Oh, time synchronization.
The Achilles heel of virtualization.
It really is. If the hardware clock on the ESXi host is massively out of sync with your network time protocol servers or your vSender server,
encrypted communication fails.
Instantly. Kerberos authentication tickets expire immediately.
So the host will just refuse to join the cluster.
Because it literally cannot trust the cryptographic certificates being passed to it.
It's fascinating how a simple BIOS clock setting can bring down a multi-million dollar infrastructure.
It happens more often than you'd think.
Okay. So we have our hosts built identically, the clocks are synced, and the hypervisors are humming.
But individually, they are just isolated islands of compute.
Right. To build a cloud, we need a centralized command center.
Which brings us to section 3.
The vCenter server appliance, or VCSA. This is covered in questions 11 through 15.
vCenter is the brain of the operation.
Without it.
Without it, you don't have vMotion, you don't have distributed resource scheduler balancing your workloads, and you don't have centralized high availability.
You just have a bunch of standalone servers.
Exactly.
Sanchez asks a critical question about the current standard for vCenter deployment in vSphere 8 and 9 environments.
He wants the candidate to acknowledge the shift away from old legacy systems.
And the correct answer is that the Linux-based vCenter server appliance is the absolute standard.
The old Windows-based vCenter is officially deprecated.
Dead and gone. If a candidate walked into an interview today and started talking about standing up a Windows Server 2022 VM to install vCenter,
the interview is effectively over.
Really?
Yeah, it immediately shows their knowledge is a decade out of date.
Why did VMware move to the appliance model so aggressively?
For several vital reasons. Managing a Windows OS just to run your management plane introduced massive overhead.
Like patching.
Patching. You had to worry about Windows Patch Tuesday, antivirus exclusions for vCenter directories.
Oh, I remember those antivirus exclusions causing so many headaches.
Constantly. And just the sheer attack surface of a general purpose OS.
So moving to Linux solved that.
Yeah, moving to a proprietary, highly stripped down Linux distribution known as Photon OS.
Photon.
VMware controls the entire stack now. The VCSA is secure by default, infinitely easier to patch, and significantly more stable.
That architectural shift also changed how vCenter handles its data.
Right, which Sanchez targets in questions 14 and 15.
He asks how VCSA handles the database compared to the old Windows vCenter, and whether VCSA still supports external databases like Oracle or Microsoft SQL.
And the answer is a hard no to external databases.
No more Oracle.
No more. VCSA relies exclusively on an embedded PostgreSQL database.
And this was a massive relief for infrastructure engineers, wasn't it?
Oh, huge. In the olden days, if you wanted to scale a vCenter environment beyond a handful of hosts, you couldn't use the free SQL Express database bundled with the Windows installer.
It just couldn't handle it.
Right. You had to go out and provision a dedicated, highly available Microsoft SQL cluster or a massive Oracle database.
Which means involving the database administration team?
Exactly. You then had to manage ODBC connections. If your SQL server had a latency spike, your entire vCenter web client would lock up.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
You spent more time troubleshooting the database connection than actually managing the virtual machines.
Yes. By embedding a highly tuned PostgreSQL database directly inside the appliance, VMware eliminated that entire failure domain.
The database is sized and optimized specifically for the appliance footprint.
Whether you choose a tiny deployment for 10 hosts or an X-large deployment managing thousands of virtual machines.
Speaking of sizing, that ties perfectly into question 11.
Choosing the right deployment size.
Right. Tiny, small, medium, large, or X-large. Choosing correctly is critical.
Very critical.
If you drastically under-provision your VCSA, say picking tiny, when you actually have 50 hosts and thousands of VMs, what happens?
The embedded database starts thrashing.
Just fighting for resources.
The VCSA runs out of memory to process the constant stream of performance metrics coming from the ESXi hosts.
So the UI just dies.
The web client becomes totally unresponsive. API calls from your backup software begin to time out and fail.
Eventually.
Eventually, the management services crash entirely.
Which brings up a terrifying thought for any business owner.
I know where you're going with this.
If my vCenter server appliance crashes,
If
the database corrupts, or the management plane completely dies, does my entire data center shut down?
Do the production virtual machines go offline?
Exactly.
This is a fundamental concept that every senior admin must be able to articulate.
The separation of planes?
The separation of the management plane from the data plane.
Explain that for us.
If vCenter goes down, it is absolutely a crisis for the administrative team. You cannot provision new VMs, vMotion is disabled, and you lose your centralized dashboard.
But what about the VMs themselves?
The data plane, the actual ESXi hosts and the virtual machines running on them does not care.
They don't care at all.
Not at all. The ESXi hosts continue to execute CPU instructions and write to storage flawlessly.
So the business stays online.
Exactly. As an admin, you can bypass vCenter entirely. You open a web browser, connect directly to the IP address of an individual ESXi host, and manage it locally until you restore vCenter from a backup.
That is the resilience of the architecture. It's built to survive its own brain dying.
Precisely.
Before we leave vCenter, Sanchez has a fantastic networking question hidden in this section.
The port 902 question.
Yes, he asks, what is port 902 used for on vCenter?
And the answer is that it is the default port vCenter uses to send data to the ESXi hosts it manages.
Why do you like this question so much?
I love this question because it tests your experience working across departmental silos.
Dealing with other teams.
Right. In a true enterprise, the virtualization team does not control the physical firewalls.
The security team does.
And they love to block everything.
Oh, of course. Default deny all.
When you deploy vCenter on a secure management network and your ESXi hosts reside on a separate infrastructure subnet, there is a firewall between them.
So you have to put in a request.
If you do not explicitly request the network security team to open TCP and UDP port 902 bidirectionally, vCenter cannot establish a heartbeat with the hosts.
And what does that look like in the console?
The hosts will show up as disconnected in your inventory, and you'll be completely locked out of managing them centrally.
Knowing port 902 proves you understand the specific communication pathways required for the hypervisor to function.
It proves you've had to submit those firewall exception tickets and actually argue with the network team.
The real-world experience. All right, let's pivot to section 4.
Storage.
Yes. If vCenter is the brain and the hypervisor is the muscle, storage is the lifeblood.
Sanchez explicitly states, storage is everything.
This covers questions 16 to 20. He argues that managing storage is where junior admins often make catastrophic career-limiting errors.
Storage is where the most complex interactions occur, and it is entirely unforgiving.
Unforgiving how?
If a CPU spikes to 100%, the application runs slowly.
Right.
If storage latency spikes, the application crashes, database is corrupt, and data is permanently lost.
That's a huge difference. Let's start with the connection protocols. Sanchez asks for the 4 typical ways storage is added to vSphere.
We are looking at ISCSI, Fiber Channel, NFS, and Direct Attached Storage, or DAS.
A senior architect has to understand the nuances of these protocols, right?
Absolutely. Are you using block-level storage over a dedicated lossless optical network like Fiber Channel?
Or are you running block storage over your standard Ethernet network using ISCSI?
Or are you bypassing block storage entirely and mounting file-level shares using NFS?
Each protocol dictates how you handle multipathing, failover, and hardware queuing.
You have to know which one fits your specific workload.
And once that storage is presented to the host, you have to format it.
Right.
Sanchez asks a crucial design question here. When setting up a new data store, how many VMFS file systems should be created per LUN?
The answer he demands is that best practice dictates only 1 VMFS file system per LUN.
Let me challenge that for a second.
Okay.
VMware technically supports multiple extents. You can absolutely take multiple physical LUNs and stitch them together into 1 massive VMFS data store.
You can.
So why is Sanchez so adamant about a 1-to-1 mapping?
Because spanning a single VMFS data store across multiple underlying physical LUNs using extents is an architectural nightmare.
How is that?
You are massively expanding your failure domain.
The blast radius.
Exactly. If you span a data store across 3 LUNs and just 1 of those LUNs experiences a hardware failure on the SAN.
What happens?
The entire data store goes offline, taking down every single VM sitting on the other 2 healthy LUNs as well.
So you lose everything just because 1/3 of the array failed.
Yes. It's about containing that blast radius. But it's also about performance and locking mechanisms.
Explain the locking.
VMFS is a clustered file system. That means 50 different ESXi hosts might be reading and writing to the exact same volume simultaneously.
That sounds like a traffic jam waiting to happen.
It is. To prevent data corruption, VMFS uses SCSI locking, specifically hardware-assisted locking, or ATS.
Okay.
When you introduce multiple extents, the metadata lock contention becomes incredibly complex. You create microscopic bottlenecks where hosts are fighting for the exact same physical disk queues.
Which causes latency.
Massive latency. A 1-to-1 mapping between a LUN and a VMFS volume keeps the queue depths predictable, limits the failure domain, and makes troubleshooting latency drastically simpler.
That makes perfect sense. Simplicity at scale equals stability.
Always.
Now, Sanchez follows up with my absolute favorite question in the entire guide, because it is a total trap.
The capacity planning trap.
Yes. He presents a scenario. You have a massive host with dual 8-core CPUs and 192 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
You have a 1 terabyte data store.
Okay.
How many virtual servers can you fit on that data store?
And the correct answer is?
It depends.
Exactly. Any candidate who gives a specific number fails the question instantly.
It is a fundamental test of capacity planning.
A junior admin might try to do basic division. They'll say, well, if I provision each VM with a 50 gig thin provision drive, I can fit 20 VMs on a terabyte.
And that junior admin will bring down the production environment within a month.
Without a doubt.
Why? What are they missing?
When you do capacity planning on a data store, the size of the VM's virtual disk is only 1 variable.
What else is taking up space?
You have to account for the VM swap file.
Oh.
Which matches the size of the VM's allocated RAM.
So if I assign 32 gigs of RAM to a VM,
it instantly creates a 32 gig swap file on the data store.
Just sitting there taking up space.
Right. You also have to account for log files, which grow over time.
And most importantly,
you have to account for snapshots.
Snapshots.
Snapshots are the silent killers of data stores.
Explain how a snapshot actually consumes space.
When you take a snapshot, say, Before patching a server, the original virtual disk becomes read-only.
Okay, it locks the original state.
Right. And all new data is written to a Delta file.
A separate file.
Yes. And if a database server is highly transactional, that Delta file can grow by hundreds of gigabytes in a matter of hours.
So if you packed your terabyte data store with 20 VMs and a backup job triggers a snapshot that grows out of control,
that data store will hit 100% capacity very quickly.
And Sanchez makes a very firm point about this in his commentary. A data store should never be allowed to reach 100% capacity.
Never.
What actually happens at the hypervisor level when free space hits zero?
It is violent.
Violent.
VMFS requires free space to manage its metadata. If a data store hits absolute zero, every single virtual machine running on that data store is instantly stunned.
Stunned. Like they just pause.
They pause entirely. They cannot write a single bit of data. They cannot page memory. They completely freeze.
How do you recover from that?
Frantically. The only way to recover is to frantically find a way to migrate data off the volume or extend the LUN on the SAN, assuming you have physical space left on the array.
That sounds incredibly stressful.
It's a nightmare. That is why the answer is, it depends. You must design for overhead, growth, and snapshot buffer space.
Sanchez also shares a harrowing anecdote about storage tiering here.
He points out that not all storage is the same.
Right. He describes a scenario where an admin sees a data store with plenty of free space and decides to migrate a massive Tier 1 database VM over to it.
Just to balance out capacity.
Exactly. But what the admin didn't verify was the underlying disk architecture.
And what was it?
The empty data store was backed by cheap 7200 RPM SATA drives.
Oh no.
And the database had previously been sitting on a blazing fast solid state flash array.
So by using storage vMotion to move that workload, the admin effectively choked the database to death.
Yes. The SATA drives simply could not handle the input-output operations per second.
The IOPS.
The IOPS required by the database. The storage queues filled up immediately. Latency spiked from 2 milliseconds to 500 milliseconds.
And the application layer timed out, causing a massive outage.
This just proves that an infrastructure engineer must have visibility all the way down to the physical disk spindles.
You cannot treat all free space equally.
And that transitions us perfectly into the other major minefield.
Networking.
Section 5, the traffic cops. This is all about networking nuances, covering questions 21 through 25.
Sanchez drops a staggering statistic here.
He does. He claims that since 2007, an estimated 80% of all the VMware problems he has had to troubleshoot were related to poor storage or network planning.
And I would argue that 80% is incredibly accurate.
Really?
Yes. Compute is relatively straightforward. But the hypervisor relies entirely on the network to communicate, migrate workloads, and access data.
If your network design is flawed, your cloud collapses. Let's dive into question 21. Sanchez asks the candidate to name four distinct things that happen on the VM kernel networking layer.
The answer includes vMotion, IP storage like ISCSI or NFS, fault tolerance, and VS traffic.
So what exactly is the VM kernel network?
The VM kernel network is the central nervous system of the ESXi host.
So it's not the network the VMs use?
No, it is completely distinct from the virtual machine network traffic, the web traffic or email traffic generated by your guest OS.
Right, you don't want a user downloading a massive file impacting the host's ability to talk to its storage.
Precisely. You have to physically or logically segregate these traffic types.
Give me an example of why that's so important.
Think about vMotion.
Moving a live VM.
Right. vMotion is the technology that moves a live running virtual machine from one physical host to another without dropping a single packet.
Which is still magic to me.
It feels like magic. But to do that, the source host has to take the entire contents of the VM's active memory, which could be 64 gigabytes, and blast it across the network to the destination host in seconds.
That's a massive payload.
Huge. If that massive payload of vMotion traffic is running on the same physical network interface as your ISCSI storage traffic,
the vMotion will saturate the link?
It'll drop your storage packets and crash the host.
So a senior architect designs dedicated, isolated VM kernel ports for each of these distinct traffic types.
Exactly.
And Sanchez touches on that isolation in question 22. He asks how an admin can separate traffic from distinct environments.
Like keeping production traffic completely separated from test environment traffic on the same physical server.
The answer gives two options. You can use separate virtual switches bound to dedicated physical network cards.
Or.
Or you can create separate port groups with different VLAN IDs on the same virtual switch.
This explores the economics of network design.
The economics.
Yeah. True physical isolation, dedicating two physical NIs and a separate physical switch entirely to the test environment, is the most secure option.
Okay.
But server chassis have limited TCI slots, and switch ports are very expensive.
Ah, so you can't just throw hardware at every problem.
Right. So you have to understand logical isolation using virtual local area networks, or VLANs.
By tagging packets with a specific VLAN ID at the port group level.
Yes. You can securely funnel both production and test traffic down the exact same physical cable and rely on the upstream physical switch to keep those broadcast domains completely segregated.
Moving from standard switches, we had a true-false question about the distributed virtual switch, or DVS.
Question 23.
It states, a distributed virtual switch is very much like a physical switch that detects which VMs are logically connected to each port, and hint, it is not used for monitoring and administration across a data center.
And the answer is false.
It is fundamentally false.
Misunderstanding the DVS is a very common pitfall.
Explain the difference between a standard switch and a DVS.
A standard vSwitch exists solely inside a single ESS host.
Okay.
If you have 50 hosts and you need to add a new VLAN for a new application, you have to log into all 50 hosts individually and configure that standard switch perfectly 50 times.
That sounds prone to error.
Highly prone to error. A distributed virtual switch abstracts that control plane entirely.
It pulls the management of the network up into vCenter?
Exactly. You create the DVS once at the vCenter level. It acts as a massive logical switch spanning your entire data center.
So you configure it once.
You configure the port groups, the security policies, and the traffic shaping rules once, and vCenter instantly pushes that configuration down to the hidden data plane on every single ESS host.
It guarantees absolute consistency across the cluster.
It does. It also enables advanced monitoring like NetFlow and port mirroring, which you simply cannot do effectively with standard switches.
Question 24 is another true-false that deals with how we connect those switches to the physical world.
NIC teaming.
It states, NIC teams are normally put in active mode to allow failover in the event of a hardware failure.
The answer is false.
Sanchez notes that NIC teams are usually configured as active standby. Let me challenge that for a second. If I have a server with two 10 gigabit network cards plugged into the switch, why on earth would I leave 10 gigs of bandwidth just sitting there in standby mode?
Right, why not get 20 gigs?
Exactly. Why wouldn't I run them active to get 20 gigs of throughput?
This is a classic trap in network architecture.
Tell me why.
If you simply set your VMware port group to active-active, but you do not configure the physical Cisco or Juniper switch ports to expect active traffic using a protocol like Link Aggregation Control Protocol or LACP.
What happens?
You will cause a disaster.
A disaster how?
The upstream switch will see the exact same MNAS address coming from two different physical ports.
The switch will think there's a loop.
Yes. The switch will think there is a network loop, it will start ME slapping, and it will eventually shut down the ports entirely to protect the network.
So active requires deep coordination with the network engineering team.
Yes. It requires complex hashing algorithms like root based on physical NIC load or IP hash balancing.
It's not just a toggle switch in VMware.
No. Active standby is the robust, out-of-the-box standard.
One physical cable handles all the traffic.
Right. And the hypervisor monitors the link state. If someone unplugs that cable or the upstream switch port dies, the hypervisor detects the link failure and instantly flips the traffic to the standby cable in milliseconds.
It provides absolute high availability without requiring complex port channeling on the physical fabric.
Exactly. Keep it simple.
That brings us to the final networking question, question 25, which Sanchez explicitly labels as a trick question.
I love this scenario.
The scenario. Mm. How many physical NICs are needed in an ESXi host for hosting 25 virtual servers on ISCSI storage split between two diverse environments like web and app?
It's a brilliant trick question because it tests whether the candidate is an order taker or an architect.
If a candidate says, well, you just need two NICs, they aren't thinking about fault domains.
Not at all.
The answer states that at a minimum, maybe two, one for data and one for the VM kernel, but realistically, way more should be used based on performance and redundancy needs.
So how does an architect break down this scenario?
Walk us through the thought process.
An architect looks at that and immediately maps out the required redundancy. First, I need a highly available management network. So that is two physical NICs.
Okay, two NICs right there.
Next, I am using ISCSI for storage. ISCSI requires absolute stability, so I need two dedicated NICs for my storage fabric.
Separated onto different physical switches, I assume.
Yes, so a single switch failure doesn't drop my data stores.
That's four NICs.
Then I have my virtual machine traffic, which needs to be separated between web and app tiers. That requires at least two more NICs for redundancy.
We're up to six.
Finally, I need a dedicated pathway for vMotion, which might require another dedicated NIC.
So suddenly, a host running 25 VMs requires six or eight physical network adapters to ensure there are zero single points of failure.
The exact number is highly subjective, but explaining how you arrive at that number is how you pass the interview.
It shows you are designing for disaster, not just for optimum conditions.
Exactly. You assume things will break.
Okay, we have systematically covered the 25 technical pillars. We've gone from bare metal hardware and BIOS settings through automated installations into the VCSA command center and deep into the complex fabrics of storage and networking.
But here is where we get to pivot to one of the most fascinating and human parts of Sanchez's post.
To section six.
Real world advice from the trenches.
The comments section of technical blogs is often a gold mine.
Because it reveals the anxieties and practical realities of people trying to survive in the industry.
It bridges the gap between knowing the textbook answer and actually operating in a high-stress environment.
Absolutely.
Sanchez took the time to respond to several professionals asking for direct career advice. Let's look at an interaction with a commenter named Ajay.
Ajay wrote in, frustrated.
He stated he is VCP certified, meaning he passed the VMware Certified Professional Exam, but he keeps failing technical interviews.
Because he lacks real hands-on enterprise experience.
Right. He asked Sanchez how to answer massive open-ended interview questions like, explain your virtual environment, or prepare a map for a virtual infrastructure with given resources.
Sanchez's advice to Ajay is arguably the most valuable piece of interview strategy you will ever hear.
What did he tell him?
He tells Ajay to stop talking and walk up to the whiteboard.
He literally tells him to ask for the marker, stand up, and visually draw out the architecture.
Yes. He advises Ajay to draw the physical ESXC hosts, draw the physical network interface cards connecting to the upstream physical switches,
draw the storage array and the LUNs presented to the host.
Then logically go inside the host and draw the virtual switches, the port groups, the virtual machines, and the virtual disk VMDK files.
Why is that so effective?
Whiteboarding is the ultimate equalizer. When you sit in a chair and try to verbally explain how a VM talks to a SAN, it is incredibly easy to get tongue-tied or sound like you were reciting a manual.
But spatial reasoning cannot be faked.
Exactly. When you draw it out on a whiteboard, you prove that you possess a systemic understanding of how the invisible layers connect, both physically and logically.
Even if Ajay doesn't have 10 years of production experience.
If he can accurately diagram the path of an I/O request from a guest operating system, through the VM kernel, out the physical host bus adapter, across the fiber channel fabric, and down to the storage LUN.
A hiring manager will instantly recognize that he grasps the fundamental mechanics.
It takes the abstract and makes it undeniable.
I have conducted interviews. And the candidate who takes control of the whiteboard is almost always the one who gets the offer.
It shows confidence and clarity.
Next, we have a commenter named Rob who posed a very challenging, almost cynical question.
Rob asks Sanchez, why do you focus so much of this assessment on information that could easily be Googled?
Like compatibility lists or run weasel commands?
Instead of focusing on deep troubleshooting methods.
It is a totally fair question. In modern IT, everyone relies on Google or Stack Traces to look up obscure syntax or decipher a hexadecimal error code.
We all do it.
But Sanchez's response cuts to the very core of what distinguishes a senior architect from a mid-level admin.
Sanchez unpacks this by stating his preference is hiring talent who can actually design and build a solid, resilient vSphere environment from scratch.
Which requires a deep internalized knowledge of best practices.
He mentions consulting for massive companies where the admins relied on Google to fix things.
But those same admins did incredibly poor, thoughtless deployments that resulted in terrible systemic performance issues across the entire stack.
The philosophy here is profound.
Break it down for us.
It is significantly easier to use a search engine to troubleshoot a broken system than it is to use a search engine to architect a secure, highly available private cloud.
You cannot Google how to design a zero-trust network fabric with proper storage queue depths for 5,000 virtual machines.
You have to understand the foundational principles we've discussed today.
Good design preempts the need for constant troubleshooting.
If you build the foundation, verifying the hardware, sizing the vCenter appliance correctly, isolating the VM kernel traffic, and utilizing one-to-one LUN mackings,
the environment becomes inherently stable.
Sanchez wants to hire architects who build fortresses, not firefighters who just run around putting out the flames caused by bad design.
Good design preempts the need for constant troubleshooting. That is a maxim that applies to almost any engineering discipline.
It really does.
Finally, let's analyze an interaction with a commenter named Asif.
Asif is currently a Windows Systems Administrator, and he is trying to navigate his career toward a Level 2 VMware admin role.
He asked Sanchez what specific skill sets interviewers are looking for today, and what the actual daily responsibilities of an L2 admin entail.
Sanchez's response to Asif is a reality check regarding the death of the siloed IT worker.
He explains that the modern infrastructure engineer must effectively own the entire technology stack.
Yes, Sanchez points out that you don't just sit in front of the vCenter dashboard all day migrating VMs.
The role requires handling the bare metal hardware.
Managing the patching lifecycle.
Understanding the nuances of Cisco or Arista networking.
And managing the Synapsyn and NFS storage arrays.
And the responsibility doesn't stop at the hypervisor layer, right?
No, Sanchez explicitly warns Asif that he will also be expected to build, support, and deeply troubleshoot the individual Windows and Linux virtual machines running as guests on top of the infrastructure.
If an application owner complains that their SQL database is slow, you can't just look at vCenter, see that CPU usage is low, and say, it's not a VMware problem.
You can't pass the buck. You have to log into the Windows guest OS, analyze the perfmon metrics, trace the latency down through the virtual SCSI controller.
Across the VM kernel.
Out to the physical SAN array, and prove exactly where the bottleneck is occurring.
The modern L2 or L3 admin is a multidisciplinary polyglot.
You have to understand how the hardware, the hypervisor, the network protocols, the storage fabrics, and the application layers all interact systemically.
It is an immense amount of responsibility, but it clarifies exactly why these roles command the salaries they do.
You are the ultimate guardian of the company's digital infrastructure.
Okay, let's take a breath and recap the sheer volume of architectural strategy we have synthesized today.
We have dissected a massive amount of technical reality.
We really have. We utilized Joe Sanchez's phenomenal assessment guide from vMinstall to map out the five pillars of enterprise infrastructure.
We started with the unyielding necessity of the hardware compatibility guide.
Understanding that ignoring the NX-XD bit or running uncertified NICs will inevitably lead to a purple screen of death and avoided support contract.
We moved into the art of installation, contrasting manual lab builds with the automated Kickstart-driven Runweasel deployments.
We're required to prevent configuration drift at scale.
We examined the evolution of the command center, recognizing the critical architectural shift away from Windows-based management toward the highly optimized PostgreSQL embedded Linux VCSA.
We discussed the critical nature of port 902 and the comforting reality that if the management plane dies, the data plane survives.
Then we plunged into the unforgiving depths of storage,
acknowledging that spanning VMFS volumes across multiple LUNs is a recipe for disaster.
And understanding why a data store at 100% capacity will instantly stun your mission-critical applications.
Finally, we untangled the networking nuances. We separated our VM kernel traffic, leveraged the immense centralized power of the distributed virtual switch,
and unpacked the complex physics behind why active standby NIC teaming prevents the catastrophic broadcast storms associated with misconfigured active port channels.
And we grounded all of this technical theory in the real-world advice from the trenches.
Mastering the whiteboard to prove your spatial reasoning.
Embracing the philosophy that proactive architectural design eliminates reactive troubleshooting.
And accepting that the modern engineer must own the stack from the bare metal all the way up to the application layer.
Understanding these elements gives you a profound, systemic appreciation for the invisible digital scaffolding that powers the modern enterprise.
It is highly complex, it requires intense discipline, but when it is architected correctly, it is an incredibly beautiful machine.
Before we wrap up, I want to speak directly to you, our listener.
We emphasize these specific questions and their architectural answers because you requested this deep dive to help you prepare and navigate these complex environments.
We want to hear how this impacts your approach. Please make sure you leave a comment on this deep dive with your thoughts, your own harrowing interview experiences, or any architectural questions that are still lingering for you.
And crucially, do not forget to download the free PDF file of these 25 questions directly from the vMinstall post.
Keep it on your desk. Use it to drill your own knowledge. or use it to rigorously assess the next engineer you hire.
It is an indispensable tool for anyone in the infrastructure space.
It really is.
And to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over as you digest all of this.
Okay, let's hear it.
We have spent this entire session analyzing the intimate, highly physical relationship between the underlying hardware, the BIOS settings, the physical switch ports, the storage LUNs, and the hypervisor running on top of it.
Right. It's all deeply intertwined with the physical metal.
But as the industry accelerates toward the public cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, and AI-driven abstraction layers, that physical hardware is becoming entirely obscured from the administrator.
Just a black box.
Infrastructure is rapidly becoming nothing more than lines of code in a CI/CD pipeline.
So what does that mean for us?
So the question I leave you with is this. In 5 or 10 years, will the VMware administrator, as we understand the role today, someone meticulously calculating physical NIC redundancy and debugging fiber channel queue depths even exist?
Or will the infrastructure engineer of the future be a pure software developer, managing massive, globally distributed, entirely invisible data centers via API calls, never once needing to know what physical hardware is running underneath, from racking physical servers to pushing pure code?
That is an evolutionary shift you must prepare for as you map out the next decade of your career.
Thank you so much for joining us on this incredibly deep technical journey. Keep questioning the architecture, keep building resilient systems, and we will see you on the next deep dive.